Hello and welcome to Not Couple Goals, the podcast where we talk about the best and, let's face it, the worst in romantic thriller cinema. I'm your host, Tyler McCarthy, here with my co-host,
Allie Nelson. And this episode, we will be talking about the 2023, although it's out now, so it's kind of 2024 as well, movie Poor Things. That's right, we're doing a new release. It stars Emma Stone, Mark Ruffalo, Willem Dafoe, and Rami Yusuf. It is directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, and the screenplay was written by Tony McNamara based on the novel by Alistair Gray.
That's right. So this is an important one. If this movie's currently in theaters, there's a lot to spoil here. So if you're planning on seeing Poor Things, or if you haven't seen Poor Things yet, consider this your spoiler alert. Pause the podcast, go watch the movie, and then join us right back here so we can talk about it. Okay, yeah, fearless with which you just pronounced the director's name. Were you familiar with him, or was that a total, like,
no, guess? I'm familiar with him. I'm pretty sure that's how you pronounce his name.
Can you say it again?
Yorgos, right? Or is it... Yeah, it's Yorgos. It looks like the cinematographer's name is also Yorgos.
Wow. Yeah, I did the trivia for this podcast, spoiler alert, and I just sort of had to gloss over his name. I had nothing, but you just, like, brazenly didn't even, like, do the thing that I usually do where it's like, Yorgos? Ghosts, I think.
Maybe. Well, he also directed The Lobster. He's well known.
I did look at his filmography, The Lobster, The Favorite, like a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Has come, pretty much all the weirdest shit that's come out in the last like 5 or 6 years has his stamp on it.
Yeah, and I mean, I saw a talk back with him, so I'm pretty sure that's how. I mean, he's Greek, and I feel like I know a lot of Greek people, and I basically
speak the language.
No, but I mean, like, you know, once you like. You get, like, the cadence of people's names and, like, the pronunciations if you've, like, you know, seen the culture and stuff.
Well, I was very impressed. I'm not trying to put you on blast. I'm telling you how impressed I am.
Yeah, I like Greek people, Greek food, Greek culture.
Yeah. And I think I liked this movie. We're going to talk about it. First, though, I guess, as we always do on this show, let's talk about what we expected from this movie going in and what we knew about this movie going in. And I guess we'll start with you.
So I did know it was sort of like I'd seen the trailer, and I definitely was like, this looks real crazy from the trailer. I was expecting sort of like a Frankenstein, like, gender-swapped Frankenstein movie. And, like, knowing, like, The Lobster and The Favorite, I feel like, is a more traditional movie from Yorgos, but, like, The Lobster was, like, such a non-traditional movie, like...
Yeah, that one was bananas.
Yeah, which I like, so... That's, I mean, I would say that that's what I expected. And then also, I knew it was very sexual. I think I, like, even looked it up to be like, why is it rated R? And it's like, oh, this is one not to watch with mom and dad because it's, like, strong sexuality.
Oh, my God. I can't even imagine. Like, you know, you can do some, like, sexual movies with mom and dad if you know, like, where the scenes are. You can pretend to get up and go to get a drink or something. They would think you have, like... bladder control issues or something if you had to get up every time they had sex in this movie.
I'll watch a sexual movie with my mom. Like, am I like, oh yeah, like I won't, if I'm gonna watch something that I think is gonna be like sexy and I want to enjoy the sexiness, I'm not like, hey, let's like premiere it with mom.
Right.
But like, I can watch a sexy movie with my mom and like not really be that bothered. Like, I don't really care.
I don't know why I'm laughing. The delayed of like, let's not premiere it with my mom.
Yeah, but like, I would watch this movie with my mom and not have an issue. Like, my mom sometimes gets embarrassed, but like, I think she also is at the point of where she's like, whatever, like, it's Allie.
Yeah, I get that. And I think, like, part of it, you both being women or something.
Yeah, we're like buddies.
I don't want to, like, experience this movie with my mom or my dad. Like,
yeah.
I would watch Emma Stone absolutely, like, getting plowed or something like that. Just sitting there being like, so anyway, mom.
I would watch it with your mom.
Okay. My mom might like it.
Yeah, she might.
Yeah, I don't want to know. I'm a boring answer because I saw... Like, basically, I just saw, like, photos of this movie that accompanied headlines and stuff like that. So I knew, here's what I knew about it. I knew that it was partially in black and white, that it was in color a little bit. I knew Emma Stone starred in it. And I knew Willem Dafoe I saw his face. So I knew he had, like, a deformed face in this movie. But that led me to believe that it was, like, a Victorian romance with possible like gothic elements, but for all I knew, Willem Dafoe was like a character fully grounded in reality who had just been scarred in a war or something like that. I knew nothing. I didn't even know how sexual this movie was. I was actually surprised when Alex Marcus, our producer, told you like you should do Poor Things for an episode of Not Couple Goals. And I was like, oh, I guess it's like a romantic thriller. Okay, cool. Like, that'll be fun. So, yeah, I went in totally cold to this movie and was pleasantly surprised.
I knew it was nominated for Oscars, too. So, like, that was a right. big... I was going to watch it regardless of whether we were doing it on the podcast or not.
What did it get nominated for? Do you know off the top
of your head? Nominated for 11 Oscars.
Good Lord.
I'll tell you that.
I do think it deserves it. It's, you know, it's... I haven't seen anything like it. Yeah. Yeah, it's imaginative.
Let's see. It's nominated for Achievement in Makeup and Hairstyling, which is not surprising. Yep. Achievement in Music Written for Motion Pictures Original Score.
Yeah.
Best Picture of the Year. Best Achievement in Directing. Best Performance by an Actress in a Leading Role for Emma Stone. Best Performance by an Actor in a Supporting Role for Mark Ruffalo. I wouldn't... He does as good an acting job in that role as anybody would. He was really genuinely great in the role. However, the fact that he got nominated over Charles Melton for May-December, I think is a little ridiculous.
Yeah, it's outside of Mark Ruffalo's comfort zone for sure, but I also think it's also a very Mark Ruffalo role, and yeah, it's not.
I think he did great. Like, I don't think anyone would have done, like, made better choices or anything, but I just think, like, the fact that Charles Melton was so vulnerable and real that I thought it was very upsetting that he didn't get nominated. But it was also nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Achievement in Cinematography, Best Achievement in Film Editing, but Best Achievement in Production Design, definitely earned. Best Achievement in Costume Design as well, also a very well earned.
And for the listener, Allie just knew that off the top of her head. She's not
reading it.
Hello, everyone. This is Amanda Rivas, the Yuji Itadori of Anime Pop.
And I'm Joss Wanecki, the Lloyd Forger of Anime Pop. Join us every month where we go over the recommendations for our favorite animes of the month, whether you're a newbie or an all-time pro, and go over the hottest news in the anime world.
We're also going to be talking about the mainstream anime that's capturing everyone's attention right now. So stay tuned. Check us out every last Monday of the month right here on the Pop Break TV podcast feed, or else I'm going to go sukuna on y'all. So boom.
My name is Anthony Desiato. When I was 5 years old, I stood in front of a comic shop advertising The Death of Superman in its window display. That moment outside Heroes World set me on a path, a lifelong fan journey leading directly from that tattered red cape to my podcast series, Digging for Kryptonite. Each week, we mine Superman's vast 85-year mythology across media with thoughtful discussions about the stories that have shaped the Man of Steel in film, TV, animation, and of course, the comics that started it all. Join us on Digging for Kryptonite every Tuesday, wherever you get podcasts. And for those of you interested in exploring the classic George Reeves television show, please check out our sister series, Another Exciting Episode in the Adventures of Superman, an episode-by-episode rewatch podcast. And remember, it's about what you do. It's about action.
Yeah, I mean, so that's what we both sort of knew about this movie going in. But for those of you who ignored the spoiler alert, or those of you who need a refresher, Allie's going to give us just the briefest casual rundown of what Poor Things is about. And good luck, because this is, I don't know what I would say for this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna just try and do it very briefly, because otherwise I'll just be recapping the whole movie. It is a gender-swapped Frankenstein of sorts. We've got, like, somewhat mad scientist Willem Dafoe creates Emma Stone, and we find out, like, the big sort of spoiler of who she is that she's a woman. She's the body of a woman who had committed suicide by jumping off of a bridge. However, she was pregnant, pretty full-term pregnant, and so she ends up being a fresh corpse for him. He takes her... takes the brain of the unborn infant and puts it in the body of the full-grown woman and then reanimates the body. And so Emma Stone is this, like, infant brain in this fully grown woman's body, and kind of her own mother in a way. It's a weird... She's basically in her mother's body. which is creepy. And so then it's like kind of a coming of age story for her from that. Her figuring out the world, you know, dealing with blossoming womanhood and like coming from like infant to woman in a very strange world. Not your traditional coming of age story, but that's that's what we'll go with.
One thing I'm like the thing I'm most excited to talk about with regards to this movie, the thing that I think was my favorite was the very imaginative world it was set in.
Yeah, it had a very Tim Burton-esque feel, but more grounded in reality than a lot of Tim Burton.
It seemed like I love this word because like a Tim Burton world is just, it's fantastical and there's just fantastical things and they exist because magic is real and present and things like that. This never went too far overboard. This felt like a Victorian era where certain technology had thrived and been embraced.
Yeah.
So there was like everything seemed grounded in that reality as opposed to just like, look at all of these wondrous things I want to show you. It was still very grounded. But then there was also like, even on the ship, which was emitting like a strange green, like smoke for no reason. When they did shots where you could see out onto the water, like even the sea just looked very like interesting and unique to this movie.
Like the color scheme of everything. And then the costuming also had just like fantastical sort of elements where it was like, it took like the costuming of the time of like an old timey sort of Victorian-esque time. And then like upped them to like, you know, where it was like an exaggerated version of that, which I thought was very fun.
In a more tolerant world too, where people of color are present and modesty among like women's clothing didn't seem to be super.
Well, I appreciated that, like, cause sometimes it can be really annoying when you're just like, I'm at the point of where I'm down for colorblind casting for like projects where it doesn't need to be a certain ethnicity. Like if you're doing like a Jackie Robinson biopic, please don't do colorblind casting. Like that would piss me off. I mean, it would piss everybody that has a soul and a brain off. So don't do that. But when you have a movie like this, like there were so many times where people were like, well, if we're doing it in the Victorian era, it wouldn't make sense to have like Asian people and like have like, you know, black people and stuff. And it's like, at this point, I don't give a shit. Like, I get it. We all know logically that the time was super racist. But if you can get away with it, just fucking do colorblind casting. Like, anyone with, I think, like, a brain will know, like, yes, okay, maybe that's true. But I'm going to enjoy watching this movie because, A, it's not just excluding people of color for no reason from a significant portion of projects. And then, B, it's like, yeah, I can just enjoy the best actor got this role versus like it being like, well, the best white actor got this role.
Yeah. If you seriously like want to point out the historical inaccuracies in a movie where like Frankenstein science exists and dirigibles are in the sky and stuff like that, if you really need your high school history teacher to pat you on the head that much, go find them. Keep it out of my movie criticism.
But don't, because I would hope your teachers were smarter than you if you're that stupid, and that your teacher would be like, shut up.
Well, I'm luring this dumb person to go see their high school teacher and get a little more education.
Now their teacher's like, you know what? I spent a year trying to get through this. Like, I don't need this time. So yeah, I enjoyed that it was colorblind casting. I completely forgot that Rami Youssef was himself like a major role. Like I forgot that was Rami.
Yeah, and he's not doing like, you know, he's a comedian, right?
Yeah, I mean he went to the acting studio that I went to, so like he's like a trained actor.
I thought he was like a comedian who took on acting.
He is a comedian. Like I think that's what he's well known for. But I'm not surprised that he's a good actor because where I went to acting, my most recent acting studio is it's a good acting studio.
You know, if you're uncomfortable talking yourself up, I'll talk you up. Allie went to a incredible acting program and is an incredible actress, and if you're trained there, you're probably pretty fucking good.
Yeah, I mean, because
Rami Youssef.
Yeah, Rami.
I always say Rami, and it's like, you always correct me, and I can never commit to memory, so I'm glad you said it first.
Yeah, because it's in the show he pronounces his name Rami.
Yeah, and his show is quite good.
Yeah.
That was good. So that was the good of the movie, but now I guess let's dive into the bad or the struggling part, which is, and I'm not the first to raise this criticism. We'll get into it a little bit in the trivia, but like there are like weird consent issues when it comes to the sexuality in this movie. I was like doing a lot of cringing at first. Eventually that kind of falls away and it gives way to, because as you see her mature into a woman, like it becomes less and less of a problem.
Yeah, because she's very intelligent.
Yeah.
You are seeing her go from like having an infant brain to like she progresses. I think that they had to add sort of the fantastical element of like she'll progress faster than like an infant would, because otherwise you're just watching like years of this woman like learning to walk and like, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So that was all compressed, because if you are trying to do this like journey of like sexuality and stuff, it's creepy for far too long.
Absolutely. And there is a stretch of the movie there where she is an infant and Remy Youssef and Willem Dafoe are like, you should marry her. And Willem Dafoe has a whole like speech about how the only reason he isn't like laying with her and fucking her is because he's like a eunuch. And
well,
no,
he doesn't say that's the only reason, but he
kind of does.
No, he says like, he's very much like, I couldn't. And then he says also his paternal instinct has overridden any, like his, the paternal feelings he has for her.
But that's sort of a throwaway line.
No, I don't think it is. Cause like it's as important as any other line in that segment where he's coming at it very scientifically, so he's not like some creepy. I mean, yeah, he's kind of creepy. Everyone's sort of a perv in some way in this movie.
Remy Youssef a lot in this movie is a perv.
Well, he's not like such a perv like everyone else. Like he does hold himself back from her, even though he is like weirdly attracted to her because she's got an attractive body. Like he isn't somebody that's like. She wants to, like, hook up with him when she's, like, got the mind of, like, a 3-year-old. And he's like, let's wait until we're married. But it's weird that he's, like, down to marry her. So there is a weirdness
there.
Weird. But he doesn't, like, violate her the way that, like, other people, you know, sort of.
But I would argue the way other, like, when she's in the whorehouse or something like that. Or even Mark Ruffalo. Mark Ruffalo isn't aware of the situation with her. He just thinks she's, like, quirky and, like, naive and that kind of thing. So
he's sheltered.
He's definitely a predator, for sure. But Rami Youssef knows the whole situation. And he's like, yeah, I can marry you. I'm aware you're technically an infant. I'm aware, life-wise, you're maybe 5, maybe 6. But let's get married and then we'll have sex. To me, that makes him the biggest creep in the movie.
I don't think so, though, because I don't. He could have at any time, because she was, like, very early on, like, discovering horniness. So if he was, like, a complete creep, he could have just, like, slept with her at any of the times that she wants to sleep with him. I think he says it later in the movie where he talks about how he sort of feels like they were both taken advantage of because he was so fascinated by her. And I think did feel this affection towards her because he was spending all this time with her. Because, like, his whole thing is that he's a student of Willem Dafoe's, and then Willem Dafoe asks him to come and like help him with his experiment, and his whole thing is that he's monitoring her and writing everything about her like day to day down. So I think he does start to feel this affection towards her, and then like it's like weirdly complicated, but he says like he feels like his fascination with her he was taken advantage of by Willem Dafoe, and in getting him to agree to marry her, because Willem Dafoe kind of pressures it.
But, you know, he's the one who has the line later in the movie. I mean, like, everyone's a master of their own ship. Like, this is, at the end of the day, some Woody Allen shit, and it's on him.
Well, but he also says, like, I appreciate when she comes back and she's, like, a fully, like, she's got a full adult brain by the time she comes back. She's had this whole adventure. And she mentions, like, hey, you haven't mentioned, like, our betrothment. And he's like, well, I have no idea whether you would want that. You were, like, literally, like, a child when, you know, we were, like, promised to each other. So
it's he recognizes she's a different person.
Yeah, he's like, it's kind of up to you. And I don't know whether that's something you would even want. And I feel like the screenplay in the movie itself does as much as they can to try and not make him like this one-sided creepy perv that's like leering at her. Whereas I feel like Mark Ruffalo is the worst in the movie when it comes to that, because he himself even says at one point, she may have like an issue, or like he says like she has an issue.
Mental issue. Yeah. Yeah. She may have a mental disorder.
Yeah. And so does the like, the madam of the brothel is like, I think she has got a mental disorder.
Right.
But he says that early on in his knowing of her, like, oh, she might have a mental disorder. And he clearly like knows that because she's so childlike when he meets her. She can barely walk normal. So,
And I think there's a lot more weight on the scene where they're strolling and they agree to get married and she asks him to marry him.
Yeah.
Remy Youssef, I'm talking about. Because you're right. He doesn't say it in so many words, but I do think he sees the person she's become based on her adventures, we'll say. To put it like, to take the straightest path through a long explanation. And I do think it's important that he doesn't say it in so many words, but he recognizes, oh, if I had married you and agreed to your dad's contract to like keep you sheltered and everything, I would have deprived you of this. Because you have, is her name Margaret Qualley or Margot Qualley?
Margaret
Qualley. Because they do get another Bella named Felicity. And they keep her sheltered and she develops at a significantly slower rate. By the end of the movie, she's still kind of this like infant child, and hopefully,
well, but I think that was the same rate that Emma Stone was progressing at the time, you know, like when, by the time he gets there, we don't know how long she's been alive,
but she's definitely not progressing at the same rate that Bella was. They mentioned that, and I think that's because not only was Willem Dafoe more detached with her, but he also didn't give her the freedom that he ended up giving Bella because he started to love her. And I think that's very telling. And I think Remy Youssef recognizes that, or his character recognizes that. And you see like what it's basically, he's like, oh, I would have been in error there. And he apologizes to her for it.
Yeah. I thought it was a nice scene where like he said that he was fascinated by her. And she says, are you not fascinated by me now? And he's like, no, I'm still fascinated by you. I thought that was very sweet.
Yeah. And it's, did you say fascinated or mesmerized?
It was one of the
two. Thing. I'm not trying to like call you out on it, but I remember really liking the line and just wanted to get it right. And I do think that softens the blow of it all. There's definitely a stretch of this movie where adult men are taking advantage of a child. But I do think the director and the movie itself, they really want you to abandon that as quick as possible. And I do think...
to go on the journey, because otherwise you are just like so cringing. And like, this is just a movie of like molestation.
Yes, and I felt that truly until like... that toward the end of the ship thing, you know what I mean? That's really when I was like, okay, I mean, she's learning, she's pulling away, she's being educated.
That's
now.
When she makes friends, and I think that that's like, it was really nice to see that they included that she makes friends with people who like want her to be smarter.
Exactly. And I think the whole movie is about, look, I think the suspension of disbelief, every movie gets one big ask from its audience. And I think the suspension of disbelief that she is 5 or 6 years old has to be done away with quickly. She is on an expedited growth journey. I think this movie wants to show what a woman's journey, and now I'm really out of my element, so jump in if I'm getting it wrong, but I think it wants to show an expedited version of a woman's journey when that woman is, for whatever reason, in this case the fact that she's an infant's brain, freed of growing up in this patriarchal society and like all of these things that are supposed to bog a woman down, trap a woman. She even says outright, like, polite society is a bad thing, like, at one point, and her new friends agree and that kind of thing. And I think that's what this story is about. That's what this movie's trying to be about. But if you let it, this movie will also be about a naive woman getting molested.
And yeah.
That's not what anyone's going for, and it's a much, much less fun version of this. And I think that's where the fantastical science comes in.
Yeah, of like, she's, you know, her hair grows an inch every 2 days and things like that. It's like she's, you know, maturing faster. Yeah. And like, he even says that when I think they create the second one, he says like, oh, you'll mature faster than you normally would, blah, blah, blah. I wish they would have explained where they got that body and brain, because I was like, damn, man, like, did you just kill a woman and a baby? Like,
I think he's just got someone standing downriver of the London Bridge. And isn't that like a notorious place for people to
if you chose, like, because he says like, let's get another body to Rami, because they miss her. Mm-hmm. They miss Emma Stone. And so... like, that seemed like they were, you know, like, it wasn't like, oh, like, serendipitously, another pregnant woman, like, you know, did the same thing. Like, I wanted them to answer that.
More than just a body. They need two bodies.
Yeah, they need a baby's brain.
A baby and, yeah.
So it's upsetting to not have that answered. So yeah, that part's
maybe it's
upsetting.
Answered in the novel.
Maybe. I didn't necessarily feel like this movie was trying to say so much about, like, a woman's journey. I mean, like, obviously it says things about a woman's journey and, like, deals with that. But I did wonder if, like, the novel was written. I don't know much about the novel or just the screenplay was written because, you know, I know about the screenplay more because I watched the movie. With the idea of, like, starting with what if we put an infant's brain in a fully grown adult's mind or in body, and mm-hmm. then you go from there and you choose whether you want it to be, you know, it's going to go through the journey as a woman, it's going to go through the journey as a man, or, you know, whatever your idea is. So to choose that, like, I feel like that was almost more of what it was, and then it became like she had to navigate the, you know, being a woman, because there's no, like, moment there where she's like, oh, I'm a woman, like, this is so much harder than if I was a man or something like that. Like, she never really has to deal with that dichotomy. So I just more felt like it was, like, not necessarily being like, this is all about, like, your journey as a woman, more so as, like, this is a fantastical story about growing up, you know, and she happens to be a woman.
Maybe, yeah, I guess you're right. Maybe the thing I was reading into was just sort of the fact that she's a woman at this time means she's courted in this way by Mark Ruffalo's character. It means when she gets to Paris, her sexuality can be a source of revenue for her and things like that.
Yeah.
So there are elements of this movie that are distinct plot-wise that could only work because she's a woman. But I guess I'll defer to your judgment on whether or not it's a coming-of-age tale for a woman, or if that could be a little more universally stretched out.
I think in some ways it's universal, but I think, like, you obviously have to navigate the world as her being a woman. Like, there's going to be differences. Yeah. But it's like, you know, if you made the movie big and tried to gender swap it, like, it's super creepy. Like, you couldn't do that.
Yeah.
No one would, because people are still really grossed out about the fact that, like, technically this 13-year-old boy has sex with this grown woman, and it's, like, a really uncomfortable thing. But, like, you can still watch Big and not be like, my eyes out.
I guess
but if you gender swapped that, you're so disgusted by, like, you're like, this man is molesting her, you know, like, even though you should kind of feel the same way regardless of the gender. I do feel like that's why it's fun to do this story with a woman, because the naivete and everything is sort of, like, almost a given when you're using a woman, whereas, like, men, especially, like, in a non-woke society, men had different expectations of them. So having, like, infant's brain in a man's body, that person's going to be treated differently.
Well, and I guess we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the closest gender-swapped version to this story is, of course, Frankenstein. And that, from the get-go, becomes this thing, it's all this really aggro thing about murder and gods and man and fathers,
but he's
and
sons. given like an adult brain.
Yeah, but he when he enters life, though, is he not,
I mean, his brain is
infantile.
Not his brain's not great.
His brain's not great.
I mean, like, that's the pitfalls of reanimating in a brain. Like, yeah. It's not,
I mean, you could say the same about Bella. Oh, it starts out not too great.
Well, I just feel like Frankenstein, some oxygen killed some major parts of his brain, whereas hers is intact. It's just an infant's brain.
Frankenstein's monster. Let's not be those people.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. If you're those people, similarly, go to your English teacher if you want a pat on the head.
Yeah, it's fine. I don't care.
But yeah, and I think, like, overall, once you are able to get past the cringy moments and surrender yourself, like, did you feel that moment where you were like, okay, I surrender, this isn't cringy anymore? Like, where was that for you in the movie? For me, it was when she steals his money that I was like, she's a fully realized person now. She's still naive. There's still some consent issues here, but, like, I'm ready to watch this woman's journey from here on out.
I feel for me, it was earlier because, she had started to really take agency pretty early on. Like, even when she was still very childlike, she'd, like, was having sex with Mark Ruffalo, but then, like, waits for him to fall asleep and goes and sort of wanders around. So it wasn't yet then, but it was when she's hooking up with him and he notices that she has writing on her legs, and she tells him the story about how she had, like, hooked up with somebody else earlier in the day, and he freaks out and is crying and he's so heartbroken. And then she kind of, like, pats him on the back and she's like, there. That is where I felt like she had this was clearly something she wanted to be doing. She was, like, very interested in exploring her sexuality. She was, you know, taking the onus on herself and going out and finding yeah. other partners and being like, well, I'm horny. So like, she didn't let this man have sex with her. She was just like, hey, I'm horny. You want to do me a solid? And like, that was fun for her. And I think that's when I was like, oh, I appreciate that. Like, she also learned to play chess that day. Like, these were like things yeah. that she was exploring.
And and she did like pretty immediately discover her sexuality. I loved the scene at the table where she discovers masturbation. And it's like weird because literally the scene before that is when you learn that she's an infant in a grown woman's body. But I did find it very funny the way she was like, everyone's got to know about this. Like she calls the like maid over. She calls Rami Yusuf over. Yeah. She's like, I found something.
There's a story in, I think it's Chelsea Handler's book, Chelsea Bang Bang, where she has like the same sort of journey when she's like around like 5 or 6. Like she discovered like rubbing herself up against like the swing set or something, like the bar of the swing set, and she discovers like masturbation, and she's like starts doing it all the time because she doesn't realize obviously that you're not supposed to do it. And at one point she was like with her family in the family room, everyone's like watching TV, and she ruined family time by being like, everyone, you need to know about this, and starts like masturbating, and her family had to be like, like, no, please don't. And I think that that's like obviously like shameful, so I don't think a lot of people like will tell their stories that they have, but I have to imagine that there's just millions to billions of stories of people like discovering masturbation as a kid and then freaking their parents out about it. Like there's a lot of about people like trying to make out with their parents and their parents being like, you gotta get the fuck off me. Like that, it's just a weird thing that happens. And I've always like, I've thought about this, like when you think about having kids, like that's, there's going to be a weird moment where your kid is doing something like masturbatory in public or just like to you, and you have to try and like, so many people shut it down with shame because it's, it freaks them out and it's embarrassing. So I get it where they're like, stop. Oh my God. Don't ever do that. And it's like, you actually have
the real lesson is don't do it in Walmart.
Yeah. Or just, you know, like, people will get freaked out if you do it in public. Like, you know, mom also doesn't want you to do it in front of her. That's, you know, but like, you don't want to make them feel like they can't. Like, I feel like our generation was maybe the last generation where the parent was like, you can't ever masturbate. Just don't do it. Like, don't, you'll go blind. You'll grow hair on your hands. Whereas I feel like I would hope that like future generations and our generation and everything with their kids, it's like, that's, you can explore your body on your own. Be safe, be hygienic. Don't touch my stuff after you do it unless you wash your hands, but like go to town.
It's a poor substitute for the real thing, etc. But yes, and I think they do handle it well in this.
Well, because she does take like a cucumber off the table and is like, look, and he has to be like, no.
Was she doing it with an apple at first?
Yeah, which I, wow, like, I don't know. I was like, how are you, what? It was confusing. Very much. There's been a few movies of the past, like, 5 or 6 years. I guess maybe more, because I think Call Me By Your Name came out in 2016, where people are masturbating with fruit, and it becomes, like, a cultural thing. I don't know how you do it with an apple.
Our generation had the savvy to turn it into a pie first.
It's true.
That's true?
Yeah. He ruins the pie for everyone, though.
He does. He does. You can't cut around that.
No.
I mean, you could, but...
No, I don't think... The pie's, like, in tatters by the end of humping it.
And, like, go to McDonald's. Don't just, like...
No, you can't really... I mean, obviously, I don't have a dick, but, like, I eat those... I've eaten a lot of McDonald's apple pies in my time. You couldn't fit your dick in that. It's not going to cover your whole dick.
You know, it'd be like Fleshlight style.
No, but even the...
Well, a pie in a pie tin.
The warmness isn't going to cover your whole dick. Whereas if you stick your whole dick in the pie, yeah, it's going to be enveloped in it.
What?
Like, if so say you did it in upwards motion. You're going to get the gooiness all over your pie.
This is bad podcasting, but I need to mime out for me how you're holding the pie.
So I'm not saying you're going direct. I'm saying you're going in an upwards motion with your dick.
Okay, so you're penetrating the surface of the pie, but then going, like, parallel with the pan.
Yeah. So your whole dick is covered in the apple warmness, which is what you want.
It looked to me like in the movie he just poked it through the top of the pie.
But I have to
assume... Which is where I'm saying, like, yes, get a McDonald's sleeve pie.
No, but he, like, lays on top of the counter and humps it. So I think he realizes you gotta, you know,
have... Does he? I thought he took it and then...
Well, I think in the deleted scene...
I can't believe... a discussion about Poor Things led us to American Pie. So
you did it.
I did it. And there was a good segue there, but we should move on. We can table this discussion for after we record.
I'm not talking about it off mic.
All right. Well, now's our only option then.
So, yeah, I mean that. So anyway, American Pie aside, that is the entry to her being like a horny person. Like we see her touching herself like in bed, and then she graduates to apple at breakfast immediately. And then when she goes for cucumber, it does seem like that's a more natural progression, because I was confused as to how either she was rubbing against the apple, or did she put the whole, did she try and fit part of the apple?
It seemed like an attempt to, this is Saltburn all over again, where I'm talking about things I may not have interpreted well, but it seemed like an attempt to put the apple all the way in resulted in a rubbing that brought her happiness.
I couldn't quite tell, but I did like that she tried to like grab her caretaker, the female caretaker. She tried to grab her crotch to be like, hey, let me show you. And that lady was like, so not down. Then what did she say? She touched
I want to hear you guess first.
She touched my hairy place?
Hairy business. She grabbed my hairy business.
I liked that. That was a good funny line.
That was a really good line. Yeah, but then so much of her journey in this movie is like sexually motivated.
Yeah, but like, I mean, that's kind of, I think, life. Like, once you're a teenager, so much of your journey really is sexually motivated. Like, that's true. Have to go to school, but, like, how much of your dynamics just in school were actually sexually motivated when it came down to it? Like, you're trying to constantly, you know, whether it was the opposite sex or the same sex or just whoever, you're even just trying to concentrate in school. I was so aware of, like, trying to be attractive to everybody. Yeah. And, like, sometimes even the teacher I was into. Like, it's like, and I think that greatly impeded my learning, because I could not have given a shit in some, I mean, I wanted to get good grades, but, like, I also, like, maybe cared more about, like, just because you're so hormonal that, like, that's just overriding all sense of reason.
Yeah, and I mean, not only that, not only wanting to look appealing and all of that, there were just days where I'd be in school and I would just be horny.
Yeah.
And anyone who can't relate to this is a liar, where you're just horny and you can't focus on like algebra 101 or anything like that, because you're just like, something needs to be done about this.
Yeah.
Like, I need to get this out of my system or something like that. And yeah, it's like all you can think about is just sex and horniness. And yeah, suddenly the teacher starts to look good. Suddenly the algebra equations that he's mapping out on the X and Y axis look a little like boobs and things like that. The sexy, sexy quadratic formula, all of that. And yeah, and so I guess that is true. A lot of it is sexually motivated. And if you are a child in an adult's body, or in many ways, if you're a woman who has an easier time being like, sex, like, that probably would be a lot of the journey you'd go on.
Yeah, and I liked the movie's use of, like, the Wizard of Oz method in its way, where it starts out in black and white when she's sort of trapped in the house, because, like, Willem Dafoe wanted to trap her in the house forever. Like, he never had any plan for letting her out, because she is an experiment. And she even asks him at one point, they're in a carriage because he let her, like, you know, have a little bit walkabout with them. They have a little picnic, and she wants to, like, go to this, like, street fair, and she starts yelling, like, he says no, and she's like, no now or no forever? And he says just no, because he doesn't really have a plan for, like the long term. He's just been, like, kind of just viewing her as this experiment / surrogate daughter. And then, so when it is kind of nice that he does let her go out into the world and explore, even though I was very worried for a lot of it that there was going to be a Frankenstein-esque situation with her killing. And I think that the movie sort of led you there in some ways, where, like, when she wants to also cut up bodies, like, he's doing surgery and she's like, I cut too. And he's like, no, you can do dead ones. And then she takes a scalpel and, like, stabs the eyes, and she's going, like, squishy.
Yeah, I thought there was something, like, rotten in her, like Pet Cemetery style.
Yeah, and then she wanted, when Rami shows her a frog for the first time, and he's like, look, and she's like, kill it, and she smashes his hands together to hurt the frog. I did think, like, oh my god, when she goes out in the world, she's gonna just start killing people because she doesn't know any better, and that's also, like, something that happens in Frankenstein. And it was fun to see that that wasn't, like, it subverted my expectations there. It was a lot of mostly, like, her discovering sexuality for a good chunk of it. But I liked that it turned from black and white in her confined, like, this is all she knows is this, like, estate, to when she goes to Lisbon with Mark Ruffalo and, like, runs away, it becomes color. I thought that was a fun.
And there is a, the movie also has a lot to say about cruelty, and you do think she's gonna start, like, stabbing people in the eye because she doesn't have empathy, or she's squishing a frog because she doesn't have empathy. But truly, like, when you discover who she was in the end, when Victoria's husband comes to collect her and she finds out that the both of them used to revel in cruelty a little bit,
yeah,
she doesn't like that. And when she's on the ship and she realizes that she's starting to have cruel thoughts toward Mark Ruffalo and things like that, she wants to do something about it. And, like, part of her journey when she's with Gerard Carmichael's character, and by the way, that was, like, a really cool thing too, where the rich get to take gondolas to this big tower where they've destroyed the stairs that the poor underneath can't get to them. That was visually so amazing. But she sees, like, poverty and suffering and things like that, and she rejects the concept of cruelty. And I also think we're meant to understand too that Willem Dafoe came from a cold, cruel father.
Oh god, it's horrible. Who the used stories he tells.
He casually tells these stories with an interesting level of respect. He respects his father's curiosity and what was done to him, and respects the man that it made him. But I also think,
like, his father was using him to perform experiments, like, had, like, made him a eunuch, had, like, tried to see if he could restrict the bones growing in his hand by, like, putting them in, like, shattering painful.
Took out his gastric system
That. Like, the, like, thing that produces stomach acids to see if we needed stomach acid. Turns out we do. And, like, his whole face is, like, has surgical scars and everything because it's clear that his father was just constantly performing these experiments on him.
And while he respects what his father did, he doesn't share his cruelty. And I think that shows in who Bella turns out to be.
Yeah. He says at the end to her, when she says she wants to be a doctor, he says, always cut with care. Always
cut with compassion.
Yeah. Always cut with compassion.
Which his father told him.
Which his father. And then he
said, which is interesting to learn.
And then he says, like, he was an idiot, but that's a good, that's a good line or something.
But it's not bad advice.
Yeah, because clearly his father didn't use that with him, but it is a good, like, I think he imparted that.
Yeah.
Because he seems to feel that way.
Yeah, and I mean, talk about a Wizard of Oz kind of, like, parallel. Other than the weird James Franco, like, prequel, I would actually love to see a prequel movie about Willem Dafoe's character. It would be dark, and it would be hard to watch at times, as this movie was. But I do think there's something so the fact that he regards his father with some degree of respect, I think is actually very interesting.
It's interesting because, yeah, he's a scientist, and he keeps talking about, like, when Bella leaves, it's Emma Stone's character, when she leaves and he misses her, and Rami calls him out on it, and he's like, I made a mistake, I let my emotions get involved, like, you can't do that, that's stupid to do that, you need to have a level of objectivity, you have to have a level of distance. And that's why he tries to do that with the next one that they make.
My favorite illustration of that too is the morning after Bella leaves, Rami Youssef wakes up and he comes to find Willem Dafoe on the floor drinking wine. And Willem Dafoe says, we're men of science. This emotionality is unseemly, as he pours him some wine.
Well, but I think that's why he's able to remove himself from that equation when it comes to his father, because he's able to see the scientific benefit of it and see his father's curiosity that led him to do these horrific things. Because it is really, like, I hate body modification horror is, like, the number one thing that really grosses me out and really freaks me out, and I don't really enjoy it. It's actually why I stopped listening to the fictional podcast Archive 81, because in the second season you get, like, a little too much body modification horror, and it freaked me out a little too much.
Yeah, but that is a trigger for you. You really don't like that kind of stuff.
I don't like the idea of, like, you wake up and you can never be the same again.
Yeah, for more on this, I encourage you to listen to our episode on the movie Fresh.
Yeah.
Because you dealt with that a lot in that movie.
Because the idea of it really upsets me. And I think maybe as somebody who's had a lot of surgery, maybe it's also just because I have woken up from surgery and, like, had my life altered in incredibly negative ways. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's like just experiencing that in real life, but it is the idea of like, you know, in some things it's like people will have like in Mars Attacks, I think that's also where it got implanted in me at a young age, like that I hated it so much because it freaked me out so bad when, spoiler alert for Mars Attacks, but like Sarah Jessica Parker wakes up and her head is on the Chihuahua's body and yes. The Chihuahua or like pug or whatever, I think it's Chihuahua, the Chihuahua's head's on her body, and that fucked me up. I think I saw that when I was like six. It was like fucked me up too much.
It's like cartoonish in the movie it's played for laughs, but you're right, that's horrifying.
It scared me my entire life, and this movie has like that aspect where like there's a pig chicken.
There's a puppy. I think it was a puppy chicken.
No, it was a pig.
It was a pig?
Yeah, there was a pig head on it that was eating off of, I'm pretty sure.
Maybe I mistook a French or a pig for a French bulldog.
Yeah, it was.
Sorry to all the Frenchy fans out there. Yeah, but before we get too far from it, I did just have a thought that I'm curious what you think about, which is that Willem Dafoe's character does regard his father with all this degree of respect, but for one line in the movie, and it is when he is on his deathbed, he calls him a fucking idiot.
Yeah,
and I'm curious if he's able to. He seemed to respect his father because his father made him the man he was, and he liked the man of science that he was. But now, at the end of his life, when he's able to look back and reflect, who should walk in the door but Bella, whom he regarded as an emotional failure, but now seeing the woman she has become and that she wants to dedicate herself to science and everything, maybe he is willing to see, like, you can achieve the same result of fatherhood by not being cruel. And I think maybe he's noticing that in the end, which is why he's finally able to call his father a fucking idiot.
I don't necessarily think it's that. I think it's like, I think it's the audacity and the hypocrisy of saying you always cut with compassion and like trying to impart that on your son when you've like maimed your son.
Yeah.
So like there was no compassion in him for his son. So I can see where like, you're like, yeah, I get where this doesn't make sense. He was fucking stupid because he clearly didn't see the like, the disconnect the that was happening.
What he
yeah.
was doing. Did you mention, was Willem Dafoe nominated?
He is not.
That's fucked. If Mark Ruffalo is nominated for this movie, Willem Dafoe should be nominated for this movie because he's so, every scene he's in, he's playing such a complicated character.
Yeah.
And honestly, we'll get into it, but apparently the makeup was enough to earn him like an Oscar just for putting in the work there. I mean, that sounds like a horrible process.
I think it's because he doesn't have a very pronounced emotional arc. Like, he doesn't have this whole journey that he goes through. Like, we see him start out and he's already paternal with her.
Yeah.
And then we see him miss her. And that's a natural progression. It's not like a huge arc. And then we see him at the end also still feeling very paternal.
I guess his arc is a subtle one.
I mean, he's great in the movie. But yes. I think that that's why the more obvious person to nominate is Mark Ruffalo, just because he has like more to do.
Yeah.
I don't always agree with that nomination. I think sometimes a subtle performance is, and not sometimes, I think a lot of the time a subtle performance is incredibly difficult, especially like a very real, vulnerable performance. And that's why I was saying like a performance like Charles Melton's, which was very, it felt very grounded and real. I'm sad that he's not nominated, but Mark Ruffalo, he got to play a much more outlandish, like sort of a comic relief-esque character.
Yeah.
And it's very, what he gets to do is very fun. And I'm not saying it's not hard. It's definitely hard, but it's much more obvious to somebody like, oh, this guy, like he had to do so much. So like he had to be sexual and then cry and like lose his mind and rip his hair out and be like drooling by the end. And like, I think that, yeah, if you're nominating someone and like, you're sort of just doing like a quick watch, you're like, ah, this guy.
Yeah. And it's outside of Mark Ruffalo's comfort zone. Sure. But I can't name one, but I do think there are other actors who could have performed his role just as well, because
yeah, I do agree.
I think as written and as intended, it's a role that I've seen before. He has to be kind of a loud, he has to be kind of a bad man, a misogynist, that kind of thing. It's not a super difficult role to play, and the arc of just slowly slipping into madness over a woman is something I've seen before. Whereas Willem Dafoe, I've never seen anything like that. And truly, like, just the arc of who he was as a person, the twisted degree of morality that he had.
Yeah.
I loved the line, because it really does. And to button my point, that is that I feel like is more deserving of attention. I will remember Willem Dafoe's character forever. Mark Ruffalo, I've seen it. I'll remember it, but like, whatever. I remember in the trivia, I didn't add this to the trivia, but it's like on IMDb, they were like, oh, his cry where he says Bella's name on the balcony. He improvised that. Like, who gives a shit? He improvised shouting her name. Sure. Thank you, Mr. Ruffalo. But the speech Willem Dafoe gives, where he explains what Bella is and what he did and all of this stuff, and he says, like, you know, I could have saved her, but she chose to take her own life. Who am I to play God in that way?
Yeah, and he explains, like, she would be in, like, an insane asylum of the time. So it's, like, back then, a lot of the insane asylums, especially for women, the insane asylums were, they kind of... in a lot of them would just leave you, and like you'd be in your own feces, like with just other people that had like a wide variety of disorders. So it could be dangerous people, it could be people just completely out of their minds, like it, and you would just be like, you know, that was before like exposés and stuff that came out to show like the conditions of how horrible they were.
Someone with like dangerous and violent schizophrenia is going to be housed with someone who like Bella, who, or like Victoria rather, who
has depression.
Exactly. Briefly experienced, not, I shouldn't say briefly experienced, but could have briefly experienced a bout of depression. And now, you know, but anyway, he completes that monologue. Cause after he's done, you're sort of sitting there and you're like, I don't, something about this doesn't seem right. And he just says point blank, would you rather Bella not be in the world? And it's kind of like, shit. I mean, you have created a very special life where once there was only going to be death. So,
I mean,
it's hard to argue with you.
Would the baby have survived outside of the womb? He doesn't fully say whether...
Oh, I took that as a given no.
I assumed no, but yeah, I mean, I guess like that was the only thing where it's like you don't have the right to then put the brain in the fully grown woman's body. But also like it is such an interesting concept for a book, for a movie. Just the idea of it. So I understand, like, yeah, you got to explore this. And in order to do that, I think like I don't know the book, but the movie does such a great job of taking these things where you could be really cringed and like disgusted by these people and gives it the best explanation possible for you to be able to just accept it and like, and enjoy the movie as a result.
Yeah. And it is, you do have to get out of your own way in this movie.
Yeah. Well, I liked the dance scene. I thought that was fun. Because I like...
I will say, if Mark Ruffalo deserves his Oscar, it's for that dance scene. I'll give him that.
I really loved the progression of the dancing. Because I like when she first goes out. It is like, when you've seen like a little kid dancing at a wedding or something, they're so funny and so cute. And it's like a lot of like bouncing and not quite... Like knowing like, the music's making me feel like I gotta move, but I don't know what to do. And it's very funny to see like babies dance for the first time and stuff. Like it's some of my favorite things to see. So to then see the way that she kind of like has this like bounciness of like, I just want to move, but I don't, like, she even looks confused as to why the music is moving her like that. And then to see him come and start dancing with her and the progression of where she gets into it. And she's like doing like tango-y, like still goofy, but like goofy tango-y moves by the end is really fun.
Yeah. I love that. And it's a good moment, too, because she stays with Mark Ruffalo's character for a while.
Yeah.
And it's not until she's read and learned enough and world savvy enough in Paris to finally be like, oh, you're holding me back.
Yeah.
So you do need those moments where Mark Ruffalo is charming again, even though those cracks are starting to show, because there's only so many there's only so much like even an infant or a child would have to endure before they're finally like, okay, fuck this guy, he just sucks.
She does have a good line, because it's like it's a line that a lot of women would say, where Jared Carmichael asks her like, why are you staying with him? And she says, I keep hoping things will get better. And it's like, yeah, that's like what a lot of people end up doing with relationships. So it was like actually a very like sort of poignant thing to say. I really liked him and like the old lady that she meets, where they're the first people that she meets where they're not going to judge her for being so blunt and strange, and they talk openly about sex with her and things. And then she's hanging out with, they're like the first people she really gets to like hang out with,
yeah,
and just make friends with. And like,
and they're terrific characters.
Yeah. They're both very intelligent. They have differing opinions from each other, and like they're well learned or well read. And so the fact that she then has to compare these people that are very interesting to like Mark Ruffalo, who she realizes is like not that interesting.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, he's good to like sex, but
he's good in bed and that's where it ends.
Yeah, but like he's actually not fun to be around, and that's why she starts having cruel thoughts about him, because she starts to dislike him. And it's funny to see like she'd rather spend time with them. She gets so horny at the beginning that all she wants to do is have sex, and she even asks him like, why do people not just do this all day?
Yeah.
And then when she makes these new friends, she's trying to hang out with them, and he's like, come to the room, and she's like, no, I'm reading, you're in my son. And I love that she's like, you're in my son. And then he takes the book and like throws it in the water. And I love the way that like the older woman smiles and hands her book. Because it's like such a funny, like mischievous moment of like, here's a book.
Yeah. Then he throws it overboard, and it's just, he throws both the books overboard and they just stare at him. And he is like a child who's thrown a temper tantrum where it's like, well, now what? And he just sort of has to storm off all impotent.
And then I also like later on when like later that same day, when she says that she's like, I have to meet Margaret for dinner. And he's like, I'll throw her overboard. And she goes, I dare you. Because she wants to see what he's going to do. And he like runs out to actually try and throw her overboard. And the way that she and her friend, like Henry and Margaret, I think is their names, react to him trying to literally throw her overboard. Like Henry tries to stop him. And she's like, no, I think that might be kind of interesting. And he's like, well, my mistake. Like, she seems very into the idea.
She's delighted by the idea of her own murder. I apologize for standing or for trying to stop you and let it happen.
And then he lets Mark Ruffalo try and drag her chair to the edge of the boat. And she's the whole time like, tee-hee. Like, she's laughing. Oh, goodness. Like, this is new.
And then she whacks him in the throat with her cane.
Yeah, once like the crew members obviously are not going to let him throw her overboard, which I think she knew the whole time. She was just like, let's see how far he gets. And then when he's struggling with the two crew members, I do love that she takes her cane and just hits him in the Adam's apple. That was a really fun bit of mischief.
I liked it. But and Gerard Carmichael's character too, he's comic relief, or as both of them are, but I also love he's sort of like this huge turning point in the movie too, where he admits he's trying to be cruel to her by showing her the
poverty.
Like, the poverty, the haves and the have nots of it all, and gets her to realize that she was born into a certain, you know, quality of life that allows her to just go to Lisbon and have a bunch of sex all day.
Also doesn't know, like, she says to him, like, she doesn't like the cruelty in her, and she doesn't believe people are cruel inherently. And he's like, no, people are cruel. They're born cruel. They die cruel. There's just cruelty throughout. And his way of proving that is to show her a slum from the vantage point of a really wealthy restaurant.
And then he has to stop her from going and doing something about it. But I do love that his point is sort of well taken. He has my favorite line of the movie, which is that hope is smashable, realism is not. And I thought, that's bleak, don't be that. But it also does prove to Bella, and it sets her into Paris with this sort of pragmatism that I think an adult needs. And it's like a great moment where she grows up a little bit too, where she realizes she could just sit around having sex all day. She 100% could. It would be fun. She could be with Mark Ruffalo and be pure id and all of that. But he gets her to realize that, look, there's more out there that's important. It's not more fun, but it's important. And that's the kind of thing you need to focus on. And she does. And I think that's very indicative of her as an adult.
I don't know that he's trying to tell her that it's important. I think he's just trying to prove his point. And also, I did like when he says to her, like, I was trying to be cruel to you because I like he didn't like seeing somebody so earnest and pure and like happy.
Sorry, I didn't mean to imply that his goal was to show her there's more out there, but a byproduct of what he was trying to do is that she realizes like, oh, like the world is not all just like sex and pastries. Like there's suffering, there's cruelty. And then she goes to Paris and she learns about depression. She learns about the trade-off of like, okay, I have to work, and I have to, that means like doing shitty things like having sex with all these gross men and things like that.
I liked that she ended up clearly she changed him too, because he realized he was being cruel to her in that moment, and the reason behind it, and he apologizes to her.
Yeah.
And he kind of tells her, like, because she bit him, because she tries to, like, run off, she tries to, like, basically, like, kill herself by jumping into the slums, and he stops her, but she bites him, and he's sort of like, no, you know what, fair, like, I deserved it, when she tries to apologize to him for it.
Yeah, they were a great character. I wonder what her life would have been like had she stayed with them on the ship, because going with Mark Ruffalo. Although I guess, you know, I love that she's going to become a doctor. I love that at no point does she ever regret becoming
a prostitute.
I love her, the madam of the, like, place. She seemed
she was crazy. Like,
she really liked biting her, which was weird.
That was the weird thing, is, like, she'd be kind of normal and kind of pragmatic, and then she would be like, I love your earlobes. Oh, sorry, I drew blood biting it. And it's like, and then when she covers her ears later to not let her bite, she, like, bites her abdomen instead. Yeah. And it's like, oh, God.
But she was a maternal figure, and she was, I love that she was basically, like, shepherding her through depression. She's, like, recognized, although they didn't necessarily have the words for it, she's recognizing, like, yeah, you're depressed. That's important, because... Yeah. When you're not depressed anymore, you're going to value that more. And I think that is also something adults like need to learn. And by the time she finally returns home, it's such a Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, because she returns home having changed. And it's just very interesting to see. I love that kind of juxtaposition between she was riding around on a tricycle beforehand, and now she's back and, like, putting her bag down and just commanding the house. It's so good.
I also like that. You know, we saw her become a prostitute, and we see her realize, like, have to deal with the realization of, like, if I am a prostitute, I will have to have sex with people that I don't necessarily find appealing and don't want to have sex with. And she tries to, like, bring that up to the madam in front of the client and say, like, well, I don't want to have sex with him. Like, shouldn't it be our choice who we have sex with? And she says even to the man, like, wouldn't it be better for you if you had sex with some, like, if you let the lady choose, so that you were having sex with somebody who actually wanted to be there? Like, shouldn't that be part of it for you? And then the madam tells her, like, later, like, listen, so for some of these men, the woman not wanting it is part of the experience, and, like, it's gross. And she's like, she's really turned off by that, as she should be, and, like, horrified. But I appreciated that they brought that in there and they showed her dealing with that, but it was refreshing in its way to not have to see, like, a movie like this, like, have, like, a brutal sexual assault or something like that. Because, like, I do understand that that's, like, a part of a significant number of women's journeys, and it is important to feature in a lot of ways to be truthful, and also to, like, sometimes, like, you know, show the realism and also just show society, like, hey, this is what you're putting us through. But sometimes it can be hard to just watch a movie about a woman's journey and just know, like, at some point she's probably going to be sexually assaulted. Yeah. And it's like, it can be painful. And as a woman, it can be just hard to watch movies, because, like, there's some days where you just don't want to have to experience that in your movie journey. Like, you're trying to, like, watch something to not be, like, have real life thrown at you in that way and not be, like, traumatized or re-traumatized depending on what's happened to you in your life. So I appreciated that they navigated they kept sort of, like, the whimsy of this, like, movie that has a lot of horrifying things in it, but, like, still dealt with consent and, like, and how as a sex worker you would have to have sex with people you didn't like and weren't attracted to and sometimes were horrified by. And they found a way to do that in sort of a new way that I hadn't really seen. Like, I appreciated when we actually saw her the next time that she has one of these men, that her way of dealing with that and sort of navigating that is that she actually wants to form a little bit of an emotional connection with this man. So she tells him, like,
clearly something she's read out of a book, like,
or she just has realized, like, she's like, you tell me a memory from your childhood, I'll tell you a joke, and then I'll sniff you to see if you smell decent enough. And depending on how you smell, you may have, we may be putting lavender oil on you. And I liked that she clearly had these coping mechanisms that she'd come up with that make it a better experience for her.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Maybe it was, so maybe that wasn't something she read out of a book and intellectualized. Maybe it was something, maybe I read that moment wrong. Yeah, it's things she determined that she was going to appreciate in this process.
Yeah, like what she wanted. Because
the madam basically tells her, like, this is the way the world works. You have to find a way to enjoy it. And so she found her way to enjoy it. Oh, see, I love talking about these movies with you. I always figure out stuff like that. I wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
That and the little dalliance she has with the other sex worker who ends up being very interesting. I like that she,
More than a dalliance. They end up kind of together in the end.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was, like, it would just seem like a nice, like, non-traditional family unit. Yeah. Whether she was, it was unclear whether she was, like, romantic with Rami, whether she was romantic with this woman.
Right.
Or they were all just happy to be living together.
That's what I meant by together in the end.
Yeah.
They formed this kind of,
like, really close bond, yeah. And I thought that was really nice. And that woman then brings up the fact that she has, like, the Victorian era equivalent of, like, a C-section scar.
Yeah.
And that's, like, a really important thing for her to deal with, too, because she wouldn't have known otherwise.
And then she goes home and she figures out who and what she is and all of that. And it leads her to be so curious about who she was that she's essentially kidnapped by that horrible, horrible man in the end.
Yeah.
Who, like, basically tells her, like, yeah, you're a prisoner. If you try to leave, I'll shoot you in the fucking head, that kind of stuff. And I love that she...
the original, basically her mother's husband. So, like, kind of her dad, actually.
Oh, yeah, I guess you're right. Man, so in Frankenstein and this, it comes down to killing your father.
Yeah. Because he is her father, but she's in her mother's body. So then he comes and thinks, like, you're my wife. I did like that was dealt with.
Yeah, because I was curious, too, why she wanted to kill herself. And I love that after a day, she literally tells the guy, like, I see now why I wanted to jump off of a bridge.
Yeah. I'm good. I want to leave.
And he kind of gives her this, like, thing. She contemplates it for a minute because he's basically going to remove her clitoris.
Yeah, he wants to do female circumcision on her.
Okay. And she contemplates it for a minute.
I don't think that's her contemplating it. I think that's her saying, like, I don't think she ever contemplated, like, letting him go through it. I think she's just saying, like, listen, the benefit of not having sexual thoughts would be this. But I don't think there's ever a part of her that's like, maybe.
I agree. I think in that moment, he's trying to make her Victoria. And her taking that moment to intellectualize what's happening is such a Godwin's daughter's moment that I think that was, like, really good. So yeah, I don't think she was ever gonna let it happen, but the fact that she paused to let it be a moment, I think, is very interesting.
But also, like, I was so thankful that she didn't do anything sexual with him. Yep. I think, like, the movie understands certain lines that you'd be like, no, because he is technically her father. And so that I was appreciative of. And he is the worst of the men in the movie by far, because he's fully just he's a horrible person to everybody. Like, he's, like, pointing guns at his servants, and, like, clearly, like, it seemed like he had broken that maid's arm or something.
Yeah,
they're all terrified of him. And then he's also just, like, tells her, like, listen, men have to deal with these sexual thoughts all day long. That's, like, our burden. But women, they don't have to deal with that because they're just for breeding with. So I'm going to put a baby in you, and then that's all you're going to deal with from now on.
He calls her territory at one point, and when she's like, I'm not, he's like, you know, you talk and talk, and then eventually you have to pull a gun, which is a cruel line, but I did kind of like it. But yeah. And
it was also interesting when he tells her that if she tries to leave, he'll shoot her. And she says, in the front or the back of the head. And he's like, well, in the back, so that I can make sure that you're truly trying to leave. Yeah. And I'm not just,
hasty.
Yeah. And I appreciated the, like, whimsy that was kept in what was a really horrifying moment.
And her bravery too, of, like, you know, you've seen that scene kind of, and you've seen the woman, like, not cower, but, like, get off kilter, everything. At no point is she, like, fazed by the cruelty and the fear that she should be feeling. At no point is she really afraid in this movie.
I think she is afraid. I think, like, when she's finally, like, sitting alone after this interaction, like, you can see that she's like, okay, this is not great.
Well, you know, there's so much to this movie. I could talk about it all day, but we're starting to get into, like, our favorite scenes and moments. And I'm curious to get into our next segment, which is, what was your favorite? I think in this movie, we should break it down. What was your favorite sex scene? Because there are many, and this was a kind of hot movie, kind of blurred by consent movie, but there were some fun sex scenes. And what is just your general favorite scene of the movie?
I wasn't super into the sex scenes because I didn't find them very hot. Like, I think that they were, like, important to the movie and everything, mm-hmm. but I wasn't like, oh, this is, you know, I'll be thinking of this later. Like, I was, like, not turned on by really any of the sex scenes. I think the sexiest of the sex scenes was probably when she was getting head from her fellow sex worker friend.
Yeah.
Because that was like the most consent-esque interaction she had. Like, it was like the most, like, as a full-grown woman with somebody that's a good person, she's hooking up with them, you know?
And she's getting emotional pleasure out of it as well, yeah, seemingly, as opposed to physical. For me, my favorite sex scene was there's this whole montage of where she's like learning to be a prostitute and she's learning to get on board with just doing this as work and emotional detachment and things like that. And it keeps cutting back to this one guy who's seemingly quite good in bed, perhaps even better than Mark Ruffalo, who fancies himself the best in the business. And then there's this very funny moment where she says, like, "You have a gift, sir." And it cuts to the guy and he's like putting on a priest's uniform. I thought that was really funny.
Yeah, I felt bad. He seemed so sad, though, yeah, when he was putting on the priest's uniform and leaving. Look, I felt so bad.
Now, it's going to get me uncharismatic to talk about it, but growing up in a Catholic, we're talking about being shunned for masturbation and everything. Growing up in a Catholic school environment and seeing the priests and everything, it's like, yeah, celibacy is unnatural. It should not be a part of any religion.
I agree, but like, doesn't he say like it's an affliction or something?
Yeah,
it's like sad because clearly like he wants sex, but he's like in this position where he can't have it. So I found that to be sad.
Yeah.
My favorite scene. That was hard because I did enjoy this movie and I thought so much of it was interesting and intelligent and just like things I hadn't seen before. So I will say two. Like, one was the dance scene. Like, I think
that's a great one.
It was really fun and imaginative, and I haven't seen a dance scene like that before. And two was, I really did like her scene with Rami when she came home and they were finally having an interaction as equals, and how they were able, she says to him something like, "I love our," was it?
Pragmatic.
Yeah. "I love our pragmatic love." Yeah. Like, because that was how it felt at the time. It was like, it was finally like a mutual respect and intelligence of them both seeing the good in the other person and why they would be good together.
Yeah. For me, my favorite scene, I remember writing it down because it was a very just subtle but funny moment, was when after Rami's character comes and tries to like, and threatens to beat up Mark Ruffalo for trying to like whisk her away and things like that. She hits him with, was it chloroform? Yeah, it was chloroform. She chloroforms him so that he won't do anything rash and so that she can just leave without him trying to stop her. And then Willem Dafoe comes in, gives her some money. They have their like little goodbye chat. And then on Willem Dafoe's way out of the room, he just very quickly like checks Rami's pulse and is like, "All right, he's alive," and just leaves. I thought that was really funny. That really got me.
I thought that was really funny too. There were like nice subtle moments like that throughout the movie where there would be like a subtle laugh.
But also when it came to just a plot-driving moment, I really did like her breaking up with Mark Ruffalo in the like city square and all of that. And because she's reached another moment of pragmatism where she's like, "I can see our journey has ended. I know what I need." She says like, I'm a flawed and exploratory person or something like that. And I'll need a husband who's a little more flexible with that. And that's not going to be you.
Yeah.
And she bids him farewell and it drives him absolutely insane for the rest of the movie because he's not a man that's used to not getting what he wants. And I think the way she broke up with him and the reasons why, it was in a movie that is a coming of age story. I thought that was really well done and well written.
I like that a lot too, because I did like that she sees him for like, he is such a child and she's like so outgrown him by that point.
Yeah.
That I love the way that like he's so angry that she like had sex with somebody else and that she did it for money, and like he keeps being like, "You're a whore, that's the worst thing a woman could be," and she's so like, for real, like you could tell that she's like,
that's the worst thing.
Yeah, so she's so like off board and she's like, "Okay, you," it's like her moment of being like, "I've outgrown you." Yeah. And you're definitely not who I want to be with, and I think she even says to him like, "I don't see the reasons that I liked you before." She says that to him, I think, later in the movie.
Yeah.
When he tries to like win her back again. And I think that's, I love the journey that she goes on. And also, I think it is unforgivable that they barely have any money and she buys them both eclairs. And this man throws such a tantrum that he takes one bite of the eclair and then finds out that she got money through sex work, that he throws this Eclair that he gets in Paris that they barely have the money for. He throws a real Parisian eclair on the fucking ground. And I was so angry. I was like, I love eclair so much.
For the listener, my wife loves eclairs. Do you remember?
A custard eclair.
Yes. Do you remember when we lived in Greenpoint and it was a very cold night? Yeah. You got it in your head. You just wanted an eclair so bad that we scoured Greenpoint until we found some.
Yeah. And then it wasn't one filled with custard, though. I don't want a cream filled one. Yeah, it wasn't very good. I want a custard eclair. And it ruined my stomach. But I remember that. But
I'll find you a good eclair.
I can't eat gluten. I'll
find a gluten-free eclair.
I don't know if that exists, I'll be honest. But yes, I'm honestly having a gluten rash reaction would be worth it for a true Parisian custard eclair. Yeah. So that was the most unforgivable moment for him in this movie.
In a series of unforgivable moments. Well, are you ready to get into a little bit of trivia about this movie?
Yes.
You sure?
Yeah.
You just answered so matter-of-factly. Yes. Because it's a relatively new movie, there's not a ton, but there are some interesting things. I culled it down. I got it mostly from IMDb. And then I did a little bit of research into the novel. And I guess I'll start there, because there's not a ton of research in the novel, but I will say its structure struck me. Because the novel it's seemingly, and again, I'm getting this from Wikipedia. I did a cursory look. If you know more than I do, congrats. Your check's in the mail. But the book is from the POV of her husband, Archibald McCandless, who I believe is the name of the character, like the husband who came. But it's his autobiography. And so he tells this very fantastical tale of brain swapping and all of that stuff. And then like the narration is refuted by Bella in her own sort of like write up about her life and things like that, where she accuses her husband of simply being inspired and a bit of a fool by the prevailing Gothic and romantic motifs of the time, including Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. So it's sort of what Gerard Kaimeka's character was talking about. It's pragmatism, it's realism versus this like fantastical hope kind of thing.
His name is Alfie Blessington, so I don't think it's...
Oh, well, then maybe the book has either renames him or has a different...
Or maybe she marries the Rami character.
Oh, yeah, what's Rami's character's name?
Let's see, what's his name? Max McCandless.
Yeah, that's probably it, because it's Archibald McCandless, so that's probably it. Maybe they just cast Rami Youssef and were like, I don't think Archibald's...
I don't know, I feel like, you know, Max McCandless is also not...
For production, I mentioned Willem Dafoe, the makeup process, and here's a quote from him, quote, 4 hours in, 2 hours out, every day. I'm showing up at 3 o'clock in the morning, sitting in the chair, meditating, and trying to deal with standing still. You can't sleep because it's intricate enough that you've got to work with people applying it. It's a grind, but I liked working with a mask in there, quite literally a mask. So that's a lot. 3 a.m., 4 hours on, two to get it off and everything, and you can't sleep, like you can't catch up on your sleep. That's
yeah. Tough. And it's also just, like, so claustrophobic, I would imagine.
Yeah. I didn't want to mention this while we were talking about the movie, because I didn't want to give anyone the ick, but what we do like to mention on this podcast, Emma Stone, 35 years old, Mark Ruffalo, 56.
Yeah, that was also part of why. I mean, Mark Ruffalo seems like a very nice man, and I do think he's a talented actor. However, I've never found him attractive. Like, there's a lot of people who find him super attractive, and like, I'm sure in real life if I met him there would be an attractiveness level, but when you're when he's standing next to Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Evans and what's Thor's name? Oh, Chris Hemsworth. I'm sorry, darling, it is hard to look handsome in that group for even an extraordinarily handsome man. So I've never found him attractive, really, and so then to have young Emma Stone fully naked grinding on top of him, that was also something that was keeping me from being like, I think if we'd had a sex scene with her and Rami, maybe I could have been more into it.
Agreed. He mentioned, I didn't put this in the trivia, so I'm going to paraphrase it, but he was basically like, oh, he hates doing sex scenes. He was reluctant to do the sex scenes, but he recognized how integral they were to the plot of the movie and said working with Emma Stone really made him want to do it, because not because of, oh, she's so hot, but he said like her sense of humor and like the way they were able to break the tension and joke about it afterwards helped. So, but like, yeah, that's quite the age difference. The movie was all done on painted sets to give it that sort of old Hollywood feel that the director wanted. Some of the sets were so massive, and I think only the, I can't remember if there was only one scene that was like shot on location, which I thought showed in a good way. Everything was practical, but not so practical that it couldn't be fantastical. And I think sound stages and building everything you want is really the only way to do that. This is funny. Mark Ruffalo had a lot of doubts about his performance during the shoot and would often joke that his friend, Oscar Isaac, who was filming in a nearby soundstage, was going to be called to replace him. So one day, Willem Dafoe brought Ruffalo into a room where he had Oscar Isaac waiting and told him, yes, indeed, they are replacing you with Oscar Isaac, which I thought was funny. Oscar Isaac, man, down for a good prank.
Honestly, though, Oscar Isaac's like maybe my favorite like younger actor.
Yep.
And I love to see him in anything, and I would have loved to have seen what he would do. I think he actually maybe would have done a better job in this role. And I would have definitely been more into the sex scenes.
Yeah, I can't name a Mark Ruffalo role where I wouldn't rather see Oscar Isaac. But yeah. Mark Ruffalo, again, you're a great guy, talented actor. There's few actors you could name who I wouldn't prefer to see Oscar Isaac. Or
yeah.
This always stuck with me because Bill Bodkin, editor-in-chief of thepopbreak.com, mentioned on a podcast about Dune, he called him Daddy Atreides, and I couldn't get that out of my head.
But it's like, yeah, somebody like Oscar Isaac brings like a level of charisma that like most people just don't have. He just has this extra level of charisma. The same way I think like if you put Christian Bale in the Mark Ruffalo role, I think he would have done something special with it too. Like, more special.
It's interesting that this got, for the stylist and everything, this movie got an Oscar nomination because Emma Stone's jet black hair was actually an accident. Because they were doing a lot of black and white and they were very conscious of the colors and wanting them to pop, she was supposed to have brunette hair, but they wanted her to get the darkest brown possible so that it would pop on camera. And apparently her colorist just screwed up and she ended up with jet black hair and they rolled with it.
Yeah.
The director, Yorgos Lanthimos... How'd I do?
Sure.
Thank you. This one was bizarre to me. He wanted Mark Ruffalo to have a bird-like silhouette, specifically that of a puffed-up pigeon, which I guess makes sense for his character.
Yeah, I think they did a good job with that.
Well, the costume designers created a puffy chest piece for Ruffalo to wear, but it was so distracting that they decided instead to just exaggerate his shape with large shoulder pads and a corset. So he's wearing large shoulder pads and a corset throughout this movie to get a puffed up peacocking bird like silhouette.
Yeah, and I think he walked like in that way that worked well, like a very like foppish, yeah, like, oh, I would think a lot of,
and when
myself.
He's dancing, the guy, he knows how to dance.
Yeah.
The director gave the screenwriter three movies to reference for the tone of the film. I've not heard of these, but I wondered if you would. The Ship Sails On, 1983, Bella de Jour, 1967, and Young Frankenstein, 1974. I'm sorry, I had heard of one of them.
Yeah.
Young Frankenstein. This was also bizarre to me. As character research, Rami Youssef trained with a mortician. He took more than 5 classes and 1800s techniques. And he, by his own admission, said, quote, "You probably only see me cut once when my character is doing Baxter's operation. But it wasn't about the screen time. It was about seeing these organs for the first time, having a sense of familiarity with them, and placing myself within the story that way." Seems a bit overkill. Seems like not necessary. What do you think? You were in the same studio as him, so can you tell us a little bit about where he may be coming from?
I do think it's just getting into the mindset. So sometimes it's like, that's why, like Renee Zellweger, when she was playing Bridget Jones, she like went and like worked at like a publisher. And like, you know, that's why people try and get, cause so that you like understand a little bit more about this character's world, even if it's not something that's going to come up.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah, because it might give you something else to work with.
Do they teach you to do that at that studio?
Not necessarily. I mean, like, I think every acting studio that I've been to has, like, that level of, like, the more you can create a backstory in your head and get to the realism of this character, the better it's going to be for you. But they always stop short. They're like, if your character's a drug addict, do not do drugs. Like, think about the time you were on Tylenol PM or Robitussin. Like, do not go out of your way to start doing drugs. To
that
like,
makes sense.
Yeah, and
weirdly is something you would have to say to some of these people.
Yeah, no, and I mean, like, I remember as a teenager, like 19-year-old, being like, no, I'm going to do the drugs. Like, that was, you know, and I think that is like a lot of the mindset.
Yeah.
Wait a second, though. Was the movie Bella de Jour or Belle de Jour?
Belle de Jour. Did I say Bella?
Yeah.
Sorry, I've been saying Bella too many times. Thank you for correcting me.
Okay.
I'm sure there were like movie fans who've been sitting here like just scratching their desks this whole time.
Yeah, my brain went, hey, I think it's
Yes, thank you. Sorry out there, cinephiles. I'm not sorry. Go fuck yourself. Hey, this one made me sad. After this film premiered at the Venice Film Festival, the director received an 8-minute standing ovation, which must have felt fantastic. Imagine getting an 8-minute standing ovation. Sadly, because of the SAG after strike, which was ongoing at the time, none of the cast was able to be there. But I feel bad because everyone did such a great job.
Yeah.
To receive an 8-minute standing ovation and just not be allowed to be present for it really stinks. But good on you all. You struck for a good reason.
It's a lot of established people. So, like, I feel like at least, like, Willem Dafoe's definitely experienced that in his career. Mm-hmm. Emma Stone, Mark Ruffalo. I feel like Rami is the one that really would have, you know, this is his first, like, big dramatic movie that's, like, you know, getting that kind of acclaim and attention.
Such a big part of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot in this podcast alone about the consent issues, and we're not the first. Obviously, people who have seen this movie, there has been backlash about the consent issues. Emma Stone and the director spoke with The Times, and Emma Stone said, quote, "If it helps, as the person who played it and produced it, I didn't see her as a child in any of those scenes," which you maybe should have. She's definitely a child in some of those scenes.
Well, I think maybe she was thinking about the fact that she had the accelerated mental.
Yeah.
So, you know, I get where because I think this is such an imaginative story to tell. Like, what if an infant's brain was put in a grown woman's body and the journey she would go on from there? And I think that they dealt with the consent issues as much as they could without having to get so into the weeds of like, okay, now she's 12, now she's 16, you know?
Well, and to your point, I think the director continued because they were being interviewed together. I think he made that point in a way that really makes him sound punchable, though. Like, it's a really condescending way. He said, quote, "But even that's too literal. If you..." Excuse me, let me try again. "But even that's too literal. If you take a film that literally, where you start discussing in it terms of the brain of a child, then you're kind of missing the point of storytelling in general. If you start to analyze the film as something that would actually happen, then of course the film doesn't work." And I'm kind of like, I don't know about that. Maybe in this case, but like, you can watch movies and take what they're saying literally. Like, there's a difference between that and being the person who's like, "Oh, actually, they wouldn't have electricity. Oh, actually, they wouldn't have that gondola technology." Or what did we say at the beginning of this?
Like a black person would be in this movie.
A black person would be in Victorian era. There's a difference between that and being like, "Oh, yeah, 5 days ago, I put the brain of an infant in her," and being like, "Okay, so she's a child."
I get what he's trying to say. Like,
yeah.
Sometimes trying to put real world issues on like a fantastical movie can crush the story you're trying to tell.
Agreed. But to say you can't take a movie literally is a little... That's also a big sweeping statement.
Well, I think the problem is when it comes to something like consent, it's so important to be constantly imparting the correct message all the time. And if the consent's being violated, like acknowledging that I think that's one of the situations where you can't be like, suspension of disbelief. It's like, nah, man, like people take this very seriously as they should.
Agreed. Yeah, that's really well put. And I don't think I can add to that, nor should I try. That's all the trivia I really had. As always, my wife puts the perfect button on the end of things. So now I'm going to throw it back to you for our last segment. Would you recommend this movie?
I would definitely recommend this movie. I always say... You're hurting the computer.
Sorry.
I always say I love a movie that is something I haven't seen before. That's part of why I really love The Lobster, because it was, again, like such an imaginative movie. It was another Yorgos Lanthimos, is that his name?
Sure.
Movie. I would recommend also checking out The Lobster if you liked this movie, because it's something that has a different plot. There were several times where it subverted my expectations. I kind of eventually just had to stop having expectations because I was like, let me just watch the movie and stop trying to tell myself like, oh, I bet this will happen next. Like, I stopped doing that. And it's hard to do that with a movie. It's hard to have a movie that tells you, that just shuts your brain down and stops you from trying to be smarter than it. Like, it's like, this movie did a great job of that. It was so fantastical. It was something I hadn't seen before. All of the performances were really great. Like, I know it made it seem like we didn't like Mark Ruffalo's, but I did think he did a great job.
Agreed.
Everybody was great in it. It was it dealt with like a lot of these issues as best as they could. And it took me on a very interesting journey. I mean, it was really long, and I don't think I even like noticed that at certain points. Like, I wasn't like, man, I went waiting for this to end. I was just like, no, I can't wait to see where it takes me next.
I did. I Googled the runtime at one point. It was when her Victoria's husband entered, and like, cause she's getting married, and I really thought this was the end of the movie. So then when I see him come, I'm like, oh, there's a lot of story left to tell.
They wrapped it up pretty fast from that, though.
That's true. I did Google the runtime at that point, but not because I was anxious for the movie to end, but because I was just amazed at how much story they had packed into this. So I, too, would recommend it for all the same reasons Ali said. It showed me so many things I haven't seen before, which is always my benchmark for, is this a good movie? And it's visually so stunning. It's not set in the modern day, but I think it found a way to deal with very modern questions and issues. And it's filled to the brim with really, really complicated characters. Look no further than Willem Dafoe's character. Bella herself is just a character who just keeps getting more complex with each passing minute. Rami Youssef, I can say so many things. I forget what it was. It was like a video about the new Star Wars movies, and someone said, hey, can you name three words that describe Han Solo that have nothing to do with his appearance? And they ask a bunch of people on the street, and they're all able to do it, and they're like, great, can you do the same with Qui-Gon Jinn? And no one could do it. And I think that's the good bench, like a fun benchmark for how you can tell if there's characters. And every single character in this movie, I think, passes that particular smell test. So I really liked it. It's filled wall to wall with stuff I just haven't seen before.
Yeah, and I also always like a movie that's not a comedy that still has like comedic beats, comedic lines, comedic moments. Yeah. I always appreciate that. I think that's very true to life and just like makes it easier to go down.
It's a light movie now that you mention it like that.
In its ways, like it deals with very horrifying issues and moments and stuff, but like has those moments of like where you genuinely do laugh. I just want to say at the end, I did not foresee the husband's brain. I thought maybe they were going to put Willem Dafoe's brain in the husband's body when they were going to do Sally.
Oh, that would have been fun.
I thought that's what they were headed towards. And like when Willem Dafoe died, I thought, oh, they're just going to be like, okay. So then to find out that they took the goat's brain and put the goat's brain in the husband's body, that was like a body modification thing that was like a bridge too far for me. It was so a horror movie. And then to have him like buying like a goat, because it's clearly the goat is in control because it's the goat brain in the human body, and he's like eating leaves and stuff, that freaked me out so much. And I also wondered, where did they put the husband's brain? Did they just throw that out?
Yeah, I mean, I guess she's not fully done with cruelty.
Yeah, I mean, he deserved it. He needed to be stopped.
I did like the way she said, he's like, oh well, I don't think if we rescue him he's the type of man who will stop. And she's like, well, I'm not gonna watch him die, but you're right, he does need improvement.
Yeah, so they
But I agree, he needs improvement.
But they maybe kill him.
They like, did kill, or she, yeah, she kills
unless
him.
Unless they put his brain in the goat's body, which they don't show.
Oh, maybe.
But I don't, if it's because they didn't show it, I don't think they did.
Also, like, if I was body swapped with a goat, I would react to the person who did that as if they had killed me.
Yeah. Also, goats are, like, kind of scary, partially because of their square pupils, so you have gotten rid of that problem. But I would be so afraid to have a goat with a man's strength that I would be so afraid to do that. I'm afraid of a lot of animals.
Yeah, they had them collared. It's fine.
Yeah, I guess.
People keep horses. Well, that's it, guys. That was Poor Things. I really liked it. I had fun talking to you about it.
Yeah, you should see it.
Yeah, if people also liked hearing my wife's thoughts on movies and all things in general. Ali, why don't you tell people where they can find more of you?
You can find me on social media. I'm on Instagram and Threads. Both are at Anal Retentive, AnelRetentive. It's like Anal Retentive, but with A-N-E-L, because that is my name. Well, a version of my name, J-Lo style. Anyway, you can also see me on
J-Lo and Anel, exactly the same.
That's how I figured out, because my friend and I were on the bus in like sixth grade, and I was like, well, if I did that to my name, I'd be Anel. And I was like, a new nickname was born in that moment, accidentally through my own words.
And T-Mac.
But I've embraced it since. Anyway, you could also find me on TikTok and YouTube, where I post sketches, stand-up comedy, fun things like that. Sometimes just videos of me dancing, but not TikTok style, just dancing in the wild. And you can find me there at Like Willie Nelson. That just like it's spelled, Like Willie Nelson, like the singer, because my name is kind of spelled like that. And then you can find my writing sometimes on parade.com. And if you want me to write for you, please reach out to me because I would like more writing.
Yeah. And you can find me on Threads at TylerMccarthy328. And you can find all of the stuff I'm working on across all of the NBC Universal editorial websites. That's Bravo, that's Sci-Fi Wire, USA Insider, NBC Insider, Oxygen. I've got my hands in all of it. Really excited for the remaining parts of Chucky, America's Got Talent Fantasy League, The Traitors. We're playing around with it all, so go check it out.
So special thanks to my dear darling Mallory Johns for our intro and outro music.
And double thanks to Alex Marcus, our producer and the person who recommended we do this movie.